This week on Pop of Culture, we'll use spray paint.
A lot of people feel like they can't use spray paint, and it's only can be used by a select group of people who really know how to use it, or who are only spraying on trains or whatever, and it's just not the truth.
We'll visit one of the oldest printing presses in the United States, and we'll sit down with a music director after a 35-year run.
It was a family, and I miss them terribly now.
Coming up,
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and by sustaining members of IPR. Become a member today at indianapublicradio.org.
From Indiana Public Radio, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette, broadcasting solo this week and soaking up the sweet Indiana summertime. Later this hour, we'll take a trip to one of the oldest printing presses in the United States. But first, we have an artist in our studio. Holly Sims is a painter and muralist based in Anderson. She was raised in Greencastle and received a Bachelor in Psychology and Arts Studies from Anderson University in 2009, then achieved an MFA in painting from New York Studio School in 2013. She returned to Anderson University in 2021 as an assistant professor of visual communication and design. And Holly is here with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We are interested to ask you WAWO, and that is, what are you working on right now, Holly?
What am I working on right now? A few main things I'm working on right now are designs for upcoming mural festivals. So there's a Wayne County Mural Fest happening this summer, as well as the Putnam County Mural Festival. So really just in the design process for those.
So when you say you're in the design process, are you going to create a mural by yourself or with other people? How's that work?
Yeah, so in Wayne County, I worked with the building owner a little bit to come up with a design, and I'm working by myself on that project. But in Putnam County, that project isn't until September, and I'll be working with the printmaker Matt Reese, and so we're collaborating on a mural. We're both from Greencastle.
Oh, well, can you give us a little bit of a sneak peek of what you're collaborating on, like some of the ideas?
Well, Matt and I have painted a lot of birds and flowers, and so we are still collaborating on what specific birds and flowers to use. But the building that we're painting on has a tropical mural on the inside, so on the outside we might go more bright, colorful, tropical feel.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's definitely fun collaborating with another artist. It's actually my first time doing that. So when picking what the imagery is going to be, who's going to paint what style goes where, it's definitely interesting meshing a printmaker with a muralist. I love working with other artists. It's very collaborative.
I do as well. I think that's really fun to talk about how it might look and your color sensibilities and some of the things that are different and that you share. Well, can you tell us a little bit more about some other things that you're doing right now?
Yeah, so I love public art, but it seems like the way I work is in different silos. So I also have a studio practice. I have a studio in Anderson based out of Eastside Studios. It's actually a pottery studio. And so I have my painting studio inside there. And in my studio right now, I'm working on a couple just commissioned pieces. Someone liked I recently did an NBA All-Star mural. And after that mural, someone was interested in that style of work connected with the Pacers. So I'm excited to do a big painting. And then I'm just gearing up. It seems like a lot of things are just at the beginning stages, designing. But I'm also gearing up for a cross-country trip to do some watercolors and oil painting.
Oh, well, that sounds interesting. Yeah. Do you know exactly where you're going to go or just?
Yeah, so this is, I did this last summer as well. A benefit to teaching is that we have the summers to create. And so I'm definitely taking advantage of that time. And maybe oil paint in my car is not the best idea. So this summer I'll be doing a lot of watercolors. And I make my way out to San Francisco and then work my way up the coast.
That sounds like a wonderful trip. And what do you think is one of your biggest inspirations when you make art?
I would say a reason why I'm doing the trip again and what inspires me the most and really gives me energy for the school year is how much color impacts my work. I would say that that's probably a common thread among all the different styles I work, is my attention to color. So as you cross the country, color just shifts, and that's something that I'm really drawn to, and it brings a lot of life to my work. Feels like a lot of the watercolors and oil paintings that I do across the country seem more like color studies. The color of the sky shifts blues as you cross the country. The soil shifts color as you cross the country. So I, on my first trip across the country, I got hung up outside of Denver because all of a sudden it shifted from the mountains and all the green. And then just on the other side, it becomes desert. And so I just ended up spending several days right there because it shifted to oranges and reds and yellows so quickly. And then moving on from there, it shifts again, you know, to like the bright blue sky, open fields of yellows and bright greens. And then as you get to the coast, which was my favorite, starts being like muted blues and like soft sky colors, using a lot more white on my palette. But
nature is a huge inspiration. I noticed in some of your work that I looked at online that you do have quite a palette of colors. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I would say that in a lot of my public art pieces, I tend to go pretty vibrant with my color palette. And I think the public really likes that. They love bright color. And I do like to balance it with the dark colors. I think that dark colors really bring to life all the rich colors. So I would say that in my public art pieces, I tend to really push that because that's what spray paint wants to do. And it can do that. And that's something that I can't quite get with oil paint. They're just different. And so I like to use materials in a way that they want to be used, you know. And using spray paint, you really just have to be brave and try it. So I think that there's, a lot of people feel like they can't use spray paint and it's only can be used by a select group of people who really know how to use it or who are only spraying on trains or whatever. And it's just not the truth. It's actually a really accepting community who's willing to like teach me. And it's, you just have to be brave and be safe with it, protect your lungs. And it's a really fun tool. It's like picking a different brush when painting with watercolor. You just pick different caps to use. How you hold the can, how fast you move the can also create all different types of mark on the wall. Actually, I taught myself how to spray paint. There's a free wall space on the south side of Indianapolis where a lot of graffiti artists paint. And I remember the first time I did it, I asked a guy who was painting there if I could paint too, even though it's not, I don't know how to do this style. And he was like, absolutely, it doesn't matter. And we need more people like you to come paint. And it really opened a door for me because I didn't know I was invited. And I actually still go paint there regularly to teach myself because it's hard to just practice on a wall. Like where do you go to practice? And so it's just a great spot and a really positive vibe happening there.
And I will tell you, an invitation is such an important thing. Mm-hmm. When you realize somebody wants you somewhere and they say, you're invited to be here, please be here.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
Well, And when we're talking about making murals and the way you conceive of them, is there something that you want them to emanate to people who look at them?
That's a good question. I would say that beauty and recognizing, I make a lot of my content just large, right? So like larger animals. And so just highlighting certain pieces to nature that people don't always catch, when it's small or in a photo. I'm not necessarily telling a story through my murals. I think that just beauty for the sake of something being beautiful is okay and alluring. And I would say that I'm more that style of muralist. I do intentionally, though, connect with communities and ask them what they want. So it tends to be the content of my murals tends to be have a relationship to the place that it's located. So for instance, the Elwood Panthers, or I did a huge panther, the Fillmore Cardinals, it's a cardinal and so forth.
Yeah, the meaning making then is very strong when you connect it to something that, you know, the people who live there think about daily.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing some of your work in the future. And thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Holly Sims is a painter and a muralist based in Anderson. You can find her on Instagram at Holly Sims Painting. In 1878, Rutherford B. Hayes was president. Thomas Edison patented the phonograph, and Tribune Showprint Printing Press was established in Indiana. Tribune has been continuously operating since then, and we took a trip to their shop in Muncie. Kim Miller is the owner of Tribune Showprint. Kim, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk to us a little bit about how you got involved in printing and the Tribune Showprint?
Yeah, so I got into printing when I was always an art kid, and then when I went to college, I was going for art education, so I take a little bit of everything, and I took a couple of relief printmaking classes. And so relief printing is generally like you're hand carving something. Fell in love, absolutely loved printing, and then started teaching, and my husband brought home a press, and then brought another press, and so I could do a couple of different styles of printing with those. And then one day there was just like a Facebook post that somebody on one of the letterpress groups was vaguely talking about needing somebody to print and having this equipment. And I kind of reached out like, I know a bunch of people. What do you need? We can figure this out. And lo and behold, she got back to me and was like, well, it's a shop we're thinking about selling up near Lafayette. Would you want to come see it? We're like, sure, we can come look at it. Again, connect you with the right people. And we left, and my husband Rob was like, I think you can do this. And I was like, you have a lot of faith in me. And so we did. We talked to them. We ended up buying it and then moving it about 2 hours across the state to Muncie. And I've been hanging out here having fun.
That is very cool. It's a pretty amazing array of type and images that you have here. And can you talk a little bit about the age? Because these machines are incredible and they look like they might be old.
Yeah. So everything in here is old, unless it's new plating. But so my main press that we make all of our backgrounds in-house as well. So if you see the rainbows or the solid backgrounds, we actually print those. And that press is over 100 years old. It was made in the early 1900s. So still works. Of course, it has its days that we have to fix things. There's some bungee cords and some people have had to weld and all kinds of stuff. But, you know, for being that age, it works splendidly. And then we have things all the way up, quote unquote, into the new times of about the 60s, 1960s. So everything in here has age to it. And there's something beautiful about it because they work so well for how old they are. And so we're into kind of trying to save some of the more rare presses at this point and keeping those for people to see and know. Actually, two of the presses in here that we have saved are actually from like 1860.
And this Gutenberg press is just beautiful.
Yeah. So it's called a Washington hand press.
Okay.
But yeah, it is what everybody thinks of when I tell them about it. It's like, yeah, you remember when Gutenberg had the big handle and pulling it to the side and, you know, two things kind of closing on top of each other. So
yeah, when you see printing in a movie, right?
Yes, exactly. Because they are very beautiful, very showy. So that one is one of the ones that was 1860. It's like 1859, 1860 from the kind of records. It was right in there. But it's been... We're fully restoring it. Most of the presses were like, oh, they have the oil and patina. They're great. They look old. That's what they do. But that one's such a beautiful press. All of its gold leaf and stuff had been worn off of it. And so we actually had it sandblasted to get all the rust off and then painted it. And then Denise King, who is an amazing human, has been coming in and hand painting all the gold leaf on it, just freehand, and it's beautiful and amazing. I don't know how she does it. So it's a really cool win. It is still in the restoration process, so we have to get a couple parts made still, and then it'll be, we're hoping by the end of the year, up and running for everybody to see.
Well, it's just lovely. There are a couple of silhouettes. I don't know who those people are. But...
I think it is Washington and Franklin.
Okay. So who are some of the people that you print for and some of the things that you print?
Yeah, so our big clients is like the carnival and festival industry. And then we get quite a few musicians as well that they use them for a variety of ways. Some of them are still using them to put up in storefronts to advertise that they're playing, and others use it as merchandise. So they'll have these as a commemorative thing, and then they sign them and sell them at shows as well. But we also do like greeting cards and thank you cards, business cards, kind of like more merchandise, fun imagery as well that we sell here. We do a little bit of everything, coasters, some people like that to advertise because they can take them, and a lot of people will take them for free and set out like with the event name on it, or, you know, even your business on it. And so it's another kind of quick way to get people's names. So we print a little bit. I'm like, if it fits in a press, we'll print on it. So
well, in terms of like design work, do you create a design? Does someone come in and ask for that? Or do people come in with their preconceived notion of what they want something to look like?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Most people, what they do is they just send us all the wording that they want on their poster. Mm-hmm. And then we go through, see what we have, and design it from there. Every once in a while, we'll get somebody that has it pretty much laid out, knowing that like we'll be picking the type out and what works in that situation. That's a little bit more rare. Most people are like, we just love your style, and you guys know what you're doing. Do it. My job is, how do I make that happen? How do I make people know what it is and when it is in the quickest way, and then add interest to it from there? But then once we set the posters, which is, I've been working on one that you can kind of see.
Oh,
you know, so this is my poster. So you can see, like, I have my letters and all of that. But in between them, there are other wood pieces and metal pieces. So when I make a line, I make everything the exact same length, even if there's empty space. And I use, like, these wood and metal pieces to make them all the same width. And that way, I can make this square or this rectangle, and then be able to move it to the press. The frame that's called a chase, Yes. We put it in that, and we use pressure in two directions to hold these together. But that's kind of like that. So once I get this all set, what I end up doing generally is running a proof, because even though I'm used to reading things upside down, there's a lot of times the letter's flipped, or I forget a word, or, you know, I'm thinking two steps ahead but forgot what I was actually doing at that moment, and, like, you know, forget a letter in there or something. But then once it's all approved, then we go and we start printing. So we started in January having an open press night, and it's every third Thursday of the month from 5:30 to 8:30. It's totally free for anybody to come in. People can just come in and learn about the shop. They can come and print. Couple different ways for people to do that. One, they can just come in, use our stuff. You can pick, you know, letters out, create, you know, words that you want to look at our imagery, use those. And some people are hand carving something every month. So they might, you know, they might be an artist that don't have access to presses often. And so they'll hand carve something, come in that night, and then print it. And so it's a lot of fun. We are here to help some, because there are people who are like, well, I've never printed anything before. And I was like, great, come in. We're going to do this. And so I always tell everybody it's very punk rock because we aren't doing it the proper way. But we're using a lot of magnets. Our whole goal is for people to see what we have, come in, enjoy the night, and get ink on paper and walk out with something that they printed that night. There's no barrier for, you know, having to have money or anything. We just want people to come in here and have fun.
And it is lots of fun. And it's very fun to look at the cuts and select what you might want to mock up and create something.
Yeah. You know, the shop is the oldest continuously operating. It's not the oldest print shop ever in America, but we're the oldest still operating. And so the history is very rich, and that's the biggest thing we want people in here and learning about. So the open press nights are kind of are one way to get people in here to see and appreciate the history of this shop. And it has always been in Indiana. So you get to see all these pieces that have been here, some of them probably from the very beginning to, you know, and we've added things, but just it's so important for us to kind of move the history of the shop forward and people to learn about it. And so that's what we really want is people to see this and appreciate it and to bring, you know, community together and artists together.
Yeah, we're so lucky to have you here keeping this history alive.
Kim Miller is the co-owner of Tribune Showprint, in operation since 1878, and now in Muncie. You're listening to Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette. For the last 35 years, Rick Sowers has served as the music director for the Anderson Symphony Orchestra. He sat down with IPR's Thomas Ouellette to discuss his career.
When did you get into music? And when did you have that moment that kind of clicked for you where you said, this is what I want to do?
Well, I had a wonderful teacher, music teacher, in junior high school, who thought he saw some talent, and he was very encouraging to me. And then as I got into music, I was in band, orchestra, and choir when I was in high school. I'm what I refer to as a recovering French horn player. So that was my orchestral band instrument. And it was during that time, and I also had very encouraging teachers in those high school days, that I thought, man, this really is what I think I'm cut out for. So after that, I became a music major and went to university for that. And that's where it got started. That's where the spark got started.
Awesome. Yeah. And so for the average person, when they see a conductor, they see a guy with a small baton and he's waving it about, but they don't really understand what that is. Really quickly, could you explain what the role of a conductor is?
Well, sure. And at different levels, it really involves different kinds of tasks. If you're walking into a really fine professional orchestra, and for instance, like one of the major symphony orchestras, and you step in front of them, they're interested in different kinds of information that you give them. And often you don't have very many rehearsals before you have a concert. And in fact, sometimes I've been in situations where I've had one or two rehearsals and then we give the concert. And we even have a saying that the orchestra's first rehearsal with the conductor is actually the conductor's first performance. But when you're a music teacher and a school teacher in music, it's a whole different kind of thing. They're not as interested in seeing you wave your arms and do that thing. Eventually they are, but in the early stages, it's about teaching them how to breathe, how to sing. So you spend a lot more time actually teaching how to do some things and not so much waving batons in front of folks. In fact, that's something that has to be taught, is to how what do those gestures mean? What are those things, and how can those things help the musicians to have a musical experience? When it comes to some of the more advanced kinds of things, I think orchestra musicians are first and foremost interested in somebody sharing a clear musical idea. And the baton indicates so many things. When you take just that, give the orchestra that first cue or a breath to play, there's so much information that's in that. You're giving them what the tempo is, the dynamic, the color, and then the baton and the hands help shape everything from the phrases and cutoffs and cues, and there's so many things that are involved with it.
I gotcha. And so it seems like it's a lot more involved than people might think. You don't just show up and start waving your arms around. That you follow them through the process, and you get them to the point that they're ready to perform. And so to kind of keep going here, so you get your master's, and then you begin. Was it just full-time conducting for the Anderson Symphony?
No, I did my master's at Colorado State, and in 3 years for my doctorate at Arizona State. That's when I got the job at Anderson. And the Anderson Symphony Orchestra is a separate organization from Anderson University. And it's been that way for many years. It got its start the ASO got its start with what was Anderson College, 57 years ago, something like that. So the Anderson Symphony in 1989, the former or the conductor of the orchestra had resigned, and that position was open. Well, I applied for it and I got it. So I became, in addition to teaching at Anderson University, I became the music director of and the conductor of the Anderson Symphony Orchestra. My first concert was in September of 1989.
And then you spent the next 35 years there.
The next 35 years there, yeah. And when I actually retired in just this past April, that was my final concert with ASO in April. I had actually been making music either at the university or with the orchestra for 40 years.
Wow. Within that time span, I mean, that's a kind of tenure very few people have really experienced. What kind of changes did you witness to music and orchestra during that time?
Yeah, the orchestra made great strides during that time. And I have to give so much credit to the Anderson Symphony Board of Directors, our sponsors, our supporters, those people who stuck with us, And also the group that I really want to stress after the musicians, who were absolutely fantastic, are our ticket holders, our season ticket holders, the people who come to our concerts. Anderson, as you may know, and I won't go into great history about this, but at that point in time, Anderson was already in a population decline. Anderson at one point in time employed nearly 30,000 people in General Motors factories of various kinds, or related to General Motors. And that was all closing up. So the town, they lost a huge part of their population during those years. And it's kind of amazing to me that the Anderson Symphony survived. As we have seen across the United States and in Europe and other places around the world, there were orchestras that just weren't able to make it. And the thing is, ASO was able to make it and really thrive. So we added a few more concerts. We hired better musicians as time went on. We attracted good musicians to be a part of the orchestra. In a lot of ways, I felt like the ASO was a family. It was a family, and I miss them terribly now. But the thing is that a lot of things went our way. It wasn't always easy. Sometimes we had to cut back. But we, you know, during all that time, those 35 years, we never had a season where we went into the red. And we had to make adjustments. We had to live within our budget. But the sophisticated music, how much more sophisticated the music was toward the, you know, the last 10 to 15 years was really remarkable. So when I left, I felt like I was a part of an organization that, you know, with the combination of all our staff and our board and our sponsors and our patrons, that we really left the organization in a very strong place.
Looking back at your entire career, was there a favorite performance you ever had, and why is it your favorite?
Well, there are several, and I know I'm going to get myself in trouble here by missing one, but just, you know, a few things. Years ago, this is quite a while ago, we had a wonderful pianist. Her name is Valentina Lisitsa, and she's very, very well known on YouTube. I think they call her the Queen of Rachmaninoff. Well, she performed with us twice, and that was very, very exciting. And then I think it was 2015, we did a concert that was a musical theater review. And we had a number of people involved in that. And then during my last season I had the first concert that we did in September, involved as soloists four of the orchestra musicians. And I loved that concert. That was so much fun. We did many, many Halloween concerts. Sometimes we kind of got into a pattern where it was every other year. And the whole orchestra dressed in costumes. I did, but we always played really good music for that. But I had a costume change for every single piece. That was good. And then a concert that we did in, it was in March this past year. I invited 12 singers who I had worked with during my entire career of 35 years. Some of them went back really that far. People like Sandy Patty were there on that, who we had many concerts with over the years. Lawrence Brownlee, who is potentially the world's leading Rossini tenor, who's a graduate of Anderson University. And he sings at the Metropolitan Opera, the Berlin Opera, everywhere. And he was a part of that concert, and many other folks that I, you know, can't take time right now to name. But that was so much fun doing that concert. And then the last concert that I gave in April, we did the Rachmaninoff Second Piano Concerto, and we did the Shostakovich Festive Overture, and then ended with the Respighi Pines of Rome. And so that, which was the third time we had done that piece with the orchestra. So those are a few of them that were wonderful highlights, and I've left out a lot of wonderful ones as well.
So tell me about the last time you performed. And what that feeling was like when you put the baton down for the last time.
Well, you have asked a question that you know, it's mixed emotions on that. I am a music director at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Naperville, Illinois. It's a western suburb of Chicago. And so I do have an opportunity to continue to conduct and work with musicians in a church setting. But so that's good that I still have some connection to that. But it was kind of an overwhelming night to realize, number one, I'm not going to be with this incredible group of musicians, many of whom are my dear friends. again, on a regular basis. I mean, I might come back as a guest at some point in time, who knows? But the thing is that that was coming to an end. But also, I've been doing this for a while. It's just in a couple of weeks, I have my 70th birthday. And so, you know, it's the reason my wife and I moved here to Chicagoland is because two of our three kids live here. We have six grandsons here. So my wife and I are trying to get used to being retired and spending wonderful time with family.
I hope I look as good as you do when I'm 70.
Oh, man, that's really kind.
I mean, geez, there's a thank you so much for your time, and I really appreciate this.
My pleasure. All the best to you.
That was IPR's Thomas Ouellette speaking with Rick Sowers, recently retired music director of the Anderson Symphony Orchestra. I'm Kara Duquette. It's the last segment of Pop of Culture for today, which means it's time to ask another artist, what are you working on? Let's listen back to a recent interview with our co-host, Michelle Kinsey.
Okay, this week we've got Maya Das in the hot seat. Maya, what are you working on?
Currently, I'm working on a gallery show for Made in Muncie. Just hung the art yesterday. It's called Coming Out of the Dark. And it is a collection of canvases, primarily black canvases with bright, vibrant, colorful, I would say natural, psychedelic, kind of cool. But a lot of it is around transformation and alchemy of negativity into positivity. So there's a butterfly and a magician and all kinds of hopefully positive and uplifting pieces for people to see.
What led you to this specific exhibit? How were you inspired to create these particular pieces? And what mediums did you use?
These are primarily acrylic with some collage work. Mm-hmm. And they're inspired by my personal alchemy of more negative or difficult emotions. I've self-guided myself through art therapy for about a decade now. And so I had a show at Cornerstone called Resurrect that had artwork from the past 10 years. And this collection, I wanted to be more stylized and focused specifically on taking darkness and making it into positivity.
I love this therapeutic aspect to your art, Maya. Talk to me about how that has helped you over the years.
I would say because I haven't gone to like therapy or been medicated or any of those things, it's been something that helps me stay grounded and on the right path. And it's also helped me connect with others. So there's been instances where I've worked with children or with other adults and guided them. Like I have an art club at Cats, Crystals, and Curiosities. We meet every last Thursday. And I'm able to kind of guide people through their negative emotions in a more positive way. And I think it's helped me in community involvement. It's helped me with confidence of self, just to be able to transmute something that could be destructive into something that is beautiful.
How does that feel to see something that has worked personally for you has that kind of therapeutic effect? Then you're at the art club or with another group and you see the impact on others. How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel like it's all worth it in the end. Yeah. Like, no obstacle can't be overcome or transmuted into something more positive, especially when working with other people, because knowing firsthand how difficult it can be to process those feelings, when I see someone else, I'm guiding them or helping them, it gives me great satisfaction.
Awesome. Tell me about your art journey. When did it start? When did you realize that art was something you needed to do?
I have always been artistic. I would fill up those little coloring sketchbooks from Walmart with the twistable crayons my mom would get me for hours.
Yes.
But when I was in sixth grade, I started to take it a bit more seriously. And then in high school and after high school, when I decided what I wanted to do for school, art was the thing that always carried me through. So I figured, why not try to make that my career? And then as I did that, I was networked into my local DIY arts and music community.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really where it kind of took off. So I would say about the past 6 years, it's been more of a business, but the past two or three, I've really honed in and said, I am an artist.
Yeah. And that is a big leap to decide this is what I'm going to do professionally. And I know that you are a recipient of the Indiana Arts Commission's OnRamp grant. Tell me about that and how that has helped you on your path.
So in 2023, I was awarded the scholarship, and it was truly such an awesome experience to go learn with 39 other creatives in Indiana, yeah, how to take art and make it an entrepreneurial business experience and career. I would say that it taught me the most that you can market yourself however you want to, and you can choose what you put out into the world. So like my art, even though it's really personal, I can take it and make prints and stickers and share it with people at a more accessible level, to where there can be a higher end gallery collectible aspect, but there can also be an accessible merchandise aspect, which was something that I had thought about but not really considered as a career option before. So making it seem more tangible was what the grant did for me.
Yeah, I love that. And talk about where people can see your work now. I know that you've done some work with a record store. And then tell us where your box is located, where they can see your work out and about.
So my box is catty corner to Rosebud Cafe, mm-hmm, on the south side. I have artwork on a gallery wall at Be Here Now currently, and I also vend at their music events occasionally. Right now at Made in Muncie, I have a gallery show hanging up on the wall. Mm-hmm. I have artwork at Cat's Crystals and Curiosities for sale. I'm working with LGR, Locked Groove Records. Yes. I'll be doing their outside across, or like on the side of their walkway. Those two big signs, I'll be repainting those.
Great.
So that'll be exciting. And then I'm working on some used record labels for them. My art can also be found, that mural is in Be Clean Laundry. I did that a few years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And
yeah, see, and I know a lot of people listening right now are doing the same thing that I just did. They're like, yes, I have seen that. And now they'll be like, that's Amaya Doss.
And yeah. I have some art up in the Common Market as well, and I'll be vending at their Saturday night markets. So I'm super excited. I feel like every month I get a new opportunity to expand more out into the community and make those connections.
That's fantastic. So where can people see your work on the socials? Like if they wanted to look at some of the stuff you're doing, if they want to keep up on what you're working on, where would they go?
On Instagram, I am Maya Doss Art, MayaDossArt. And I have a website, MayaDoss.com. And when you type it in, it may autocorrect to Matadors, but it is Maya Doss.
That is an interesting autocorrect.
I was an unforeseen issue on my end.
What are you? It sounds like you have really set your sights on a lot of great things, and you're achieving them every day. What, looking into the future, what are some things, what are some goals that you have artistically for your future, Maya?
Artistically in the future, I would like to make more video content, both time lapses of me creating my work. I would also like to share more about just my process, like vlogs of my day-to-day as an artist. I also see myself possibly having my own personal studio that doubles as a store. That's in the future, though, long-term. Right now, I have a booth at Frankie D's, booth 102, so you might find some art in there.
Awesome.
But in the future, I guess more licensing stuff, yeah. So like making art for local bands. I've made a lot of album art and flyers. I love doing that.
Nice.
So I guess just continuing to really make art in all different directions, whichever way I feel inspired, and to work with more people in the community.
Well, we look forward to seeing all of that and more from you, Maya. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful.
Luke, let's talk about what's happening this weekend in our arts calendar.
Hi, Kara. It is America's birthday. There's lots of ways to celebrate this weekend, including Prairie Creek has an Independence Day party Saturday, July 6th. It will include performances by Cook and Bell and the Remedy Band. And it is, of course, the perfect weekend to wander through a farmer's market with your family or by yourself. There is one in Elwood on Saturday at the Elwood City Building until 2 p.m. And then there are farmers markets at Minnetrista, Anderson, and at Falls Park in Pendleton, all until either noon or 12:30.
Lots to choose from. I love farmers markets. Also, in downtown Muncie will be the site of Cars and Coffee on Saturday, July 6th, beginning at 9 a.m. You can cruise in, hang out, talk cars, and drink some coffee. The event is the first Saturday of every month through November.
Ooh. I love this event. Is the solution to America's polarization problem jokes?
Yeah.
Fine. Solved it. Find out when the Great American Punchline comes to Muncie on Monday, July 8th. Hosted by comedian and NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist Najeen Farsad, this interactive event and live comedy show also features Chris Gethard, Ali Sultan, Maggie Crane, and many, many more. Prepare to hear heartfelt, funny stories about America and learn about finding human connections and tapping into our humanity through comedy. The show is at 7 p.m. at the Common Market on Muncie's South Side. More information on the Common Market social media pages.
I will definitely be going to that. That sounds amazing.
Michelle Kinsey and I are already going to be there.
Oh, I'll see you there then.
All right.
The Delaware County Fair kicks off July 8th with 4-H festivities. The County Fair in Midway will be open July 15th through the 20th. For more information, go to DelawareCountyFair.net.
All right, I need you to, like, calendar brain for me here.
Okay.
First Thursday is second Thursday this month in downtown Muncie. Because there's something else happening on the first Thursday of the month. The event will be 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday, July 11th. You can check out new exhibits at downtown galleries and shops and support community artisans as you explore downtown. The website is downtownmuncie.org if you need more info.
So just when you think you've missed First Thursday, remember, it's second Thursday.
Honestly, it's the perfect timing for me.
The Iron Man is in Muncie this weekend and will include a whole weekend of activities. On July 11th, enjoy a free performance by the Dave Bennett Quartet at 8 p.m. at Cannon Commons. On July 12th, there's a family picnic at Cannon Commons that will include an outdoor screening of Breaking Away. And on July 13th, is the big triathlon with swimming and biking and running. We're exhausted just thinking about it. Ironman.com has more info.
Kara, will you be, did you qualify for this year's Ironman?
I did not.
I did not either.
I did not try.
Yeah, me either. I don't think anyone needs to see me swimming, biking, or running. All right. Have an event that Pop of Culture listeners should know about? Tell us! IndianaPublicRadio.org/Pop of Culture or through the Ball State Public Media app. Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and by sustaining members of IPR. Become a member today at IndianaPublicRadio.org.
And that's our show. This week was produced by Luke Jones, who is rooting for everyone actually racing in the Ironman. Our arts calendar was written this week by Michelle Kinsey, and the show was hosted by me, Kara Duquette. Pop of Culture is a production of Indiana Public Radio on the campus of Ball State University.